Case number 12-3083, United States of America v. Yahya Ali Zaitar, also known as Abu Rahib, also known as Yahya Ali Daoud Zaitar, appellant. Mr. Sussman for appellant. Ms. Heller for appellee.
Good morning. I'm Ed Sussman on behalf of the appellant, Yahya Zaitar. I'm in a somewhat unusual position this morning. Generally, when I'm at this lectern, I'm asking the court to do something it either rarely does or almost never does. This morning, I'm asking the court to do something that is done both routinely and fairly consistently. As the court well knows, the District of Columbia is unique in allowing appellants who assert a claim of ineffectiveness of counsel for the first time on appeal to have their matter remanded if the record is insufficient for this court to make the decision. And I would submit that that is exactly the situation we're in. And instead of going through the 2255 route, I know that Judge Kavanaugh has commented about that in a recent decision, but that remains the law for whatever the wisdom is with regard to that. And in fact, because it exists, it has become somewhat of the gold standard of practice where attorneys are routinely counseled not to extinguish or burn a client's 1-2255 in this kind of situation, and utilize the appellate remand model. That while it's certainly a slower way to seek the remedy, it is it does allow someone to preserve that 2255 and see what the future might bring from a legal perspective, and that is exactly what Mr. Zaitar is requesting. The government is quite correct in the sense that Mr. Zaitar did waive certain rights at the time that he entered the plea. He waived the right to contest the sentence as such, and that is not what he is doing. He waived the right to contest guilt. That was, and that is not what he's doing. He's not claiming that the factual proffer was insufficient, or that it doesn't make out the offense, or the offense is not one cognizable under the laws. Those are not his claims. His claim was that he was simply induced by his counsel at the time, for counsel for purposes of the plea, to plead guilty by a promise. And I highlight the word promise, not a not an estimate or a projection as to what the likely sentence might be, but he considers it to be a promise. And this was something that Mr. Zaitar mentioned immediately upon it at the time of the sentencing. So this was not something that was not raised in some manner immediately upon the imposition of the sentence. The court must keep in mind that that Zaitar was a Lebanese citizen. English was certainly not his first language, and all of the proceedings were translated through an Arabic translator, which raises additional issues concerning confusion or what Mr. Zaitar might have understood or known. I don't believe that this court should be concerned with the merits, particularly at this point. I mean, the district court is in a unique posture to deal with it. And admittedly, Mr. Zaitar probably has an uphill fight when he gets to the district court level. But I see nothing in terms of the court's past record of deciding these kind of matters that should preclude that direction. And I would think that that the court should follow what it has consistently followed since Muhammad, and in several cases that followed Muhammad, that the district court is the best place to resolve these kinds of issues, either through the remand procedure or through the 2255 procedure. In this case, obviously, we're requesting that it be through the remand. And I think the argument is simple and straightforward. And although I have not used up my time, if the court feels that there are any questions about this particular case that it wants to ask, I'm certainly here to answer them.
As I understand your theory, you're on the second element of the ineffective assistance claim, prejudice. Right, your argument is that he was prejudiced because he could have he could have appealed the Speedy Trial Act ruling and succeeded, correct?
Well, that's one thing he could have done. That right was forfeited by the plaintiff.
Yeah, but I was going to ask you, there were two indictments here, correct?
For two different drugs, correct.
Two different drugs, yeah. And the Speedy Trial, district court decision in the Speedy Trial case was in the heroin indictment, right?
I believe that's correct.
Yeah. So even if he had succeeded in that, he pled to the identical cocaine indictment, which carried exactly the same penalty. So where would there have been any prejudice here?
Well, I think that speedy trial is one of the things that he would seek
but,
to...
But do you see my point about...
I do, exactly, but I think
that... What else is there in terms
of... Well, I think the larger question is the question that Mr. Zaitar would raise about being induced to enter the plea by virtue of the promise that was made to him.
And then he would have gone to trial and been acquitted?
I don't think that you have to prove that you would be acquitted. I think that this is... substantial probability that the result would have been different would have been that you would have gone to trial and had some colorable claim.
Even given what he said in the plea agreement and even given that all of these conversations were taped?
Well, the question of the factual basis is what the factual basis is. I assume that and I've seen one explain or try to explain themselves in all kinds of situations. Mm-hmm. Obviously, when someone pleads guilty, the factual proffer and their admissions are fairly damning in terms of the proceedings. And the only pleas that would be accepted are ones that fall into that category. If Mr. Zaitar believes that. First of all, the standard is not innocence for withdrawing your plea.
Yeah, I totally understand that.
So that's a different question. Right. The question is if he was...
I was just asking about the concessions in the plea agreement and saying that all the...
They're certainly not helpful.
Right, they're not helpful.
Nor feathers in his cap. But
it's true.
That's the case in every plea withdrawal situation.
Never cases use the verb evaporate with respect to
I've seen many cases in which the Rule 11 colloquy seems to trump just about any argument that might be made. But again, there's
a
factual...
That's the purpose of the Rule 11.
Obviously.
Being spelled out in such exhaustive detail.
Well, at the risk of repeating myself, there are things that might well happen outside the courtroom or outside the Rule 11 colloquy that a court could not help but take notice of. And the notion that the Rule 11 by itself trumps any event or any possibility that might exist simultaneously with the Rule 11 colloquy is a dangerous one. People can plead guilty because of threats made to family, because of a lot of reasons that may well cause them to make the decisions they made.
I mean, here we have to assume that the lawyer said things that your client says he said. But we don't have to, that doesn't tell us how significant that would have been in your client's thinking. And as we look at the Rule 11 colloquy, seems to me that the failure to utter a word of startlement or anything like that about what the judge is telling him suggests that this promise was not taken by the insider. It's counting for much.
Well, if we're getting to the point where the rule...
Squawk, right? I mean, that's a natural thing to do.
Not if you believe that you're going to get a sentence that is the one you want, and that's the driver in these kinds of plea agreements. If in fact someone is assured of a particular sentence, and they have every incentive to answer the questions without squawking, as the court in terms of the terminology of the court. What utility is there to complain when you believe you're getting what you think you're getting? Make no mistake about it, you know, the court is pointing out what we all know, that Zaitar has formidable barriers in any kind of either remand or 2255 situation. But I don't think that the uphill fight forecloses the inquiry. I think that this is exactly the kind of question that the district court has to determine, has to make a credibility determination concerning Mr. Zaitar and his counsel.
Do you have any cases as weak as this where we did send it back? I mean, I know that all cases have their own special wrinkles, but it looks like a very strong prosecution case. A Rule 11 colloquy seems to be completely satisfactory.
I can't point to a specific case, and the reason I think that it's difficult to find one is that the court, when it remands, generally doesn't get into an extensive recitation of the facts, because the court recognizes that that's not its job. Its job is to let someone else determine the facts, and the decisions are not fact-heavy. They generally lean on the procedure and the fairly constant, consistent procedural maneuver of sending it back to the district court for first swing.
Anything else? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Kirby Heller for the United States. It's our position that this is one of the unusual cases in which remand on this question is not necessary. And that is, even accepting that this promise was made, that the defendant has not made a colorable claim of prejudice in this case. He has never said, and this is critical, that but for this erroneous advice, he would have gone to trial. There's no suggestion of that below. There's not even a suggestion of that or a statement of that on appeal, and even when the government made that the centerpiece of its argument in its answering brief, in the reply brief, the defendant did not come back and say.
This isn't the place for the factual assertions to be made, an affidavit or something, right? That's why we remanded the district court.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor, but there has to be at least a showing. As this court has said, it doesn't reflexively remand. There has to be this colorable showing. And there is no colorable showing here.
You agree that the Rule 11 colloquy does not extinguish an ineffective assistance claim, correct?
It doesn't extinguish it. In this case, it would be considered, obviously. It should be considered. Something that's interesting about this case and makes it a little bit different from other cases is not only, of course, were there the warnings and discussions at the Rule 11 colloquy, which was by the book, but there were a couple events after that. The first was that the PSR came out and it did not agree with the estimation of the guidelines that both parties had put in the plea agreement that had been discussed at the colloquy, the Rule 11 colloquy. And again, there was not even an objection to that. The next thing that happened that was very important was there was this sentencing that was supposed to take place in August of 2011, I believe, where there was an extended discussion about whether the court, in fact, could consider the drug quantities that the co-conspirators or co-defendant had pleaded to, again, alerting the defendant that whatever promise he had gotten was not necessarily going to be followed by the court.
Doesn't all of this depend on the conversations between the defendant and the counsel?
Well, certainly.
And we don't know what those are.
We don't know what those are.
I don't know how we can assume or find something, because we could dream up conversations that could have occurred that I think you would agree would have to go back. And given that we could conceive of those and we can't find the facts here, that kind of ends the matter, doesn't it?
Well, even assuming, though, that counsel was reassuring the defendant all along, don't worry, what's happening, we have these events which, at a minimum, one would expect a motion to withdraw the plea. And that's what never happened after each of these events. The defendant keeps promising, allegedly.
But at sentencing, the defendant reacted, right?
The defendant, that's when he reacted, when all of a sudden he got a sentence that he was not happy with. And
that's the key, right? That shows that it could have all been an act, right? That's one thing. But the other thing could be that he was legitimately surprised because his attorney had promised him something, and we don't really know what happened there.
Well, and we're assuming that he did. Obviously, we can't. There is a factual dispute about the first prong of the Strickland analysis. We're assuming he did and going straight to the second prong, right, to the prejudice, and that's where there's just nothing in this record, even assuming everything he alleged is true, that shows he would have gone to trial if, in fact, he hadn't, if he had been told that, if he hadn't been promised that his sentence would be a certain
There's
number.
There's nothing in the record that says he wouldn't have.
No, but he has to make some showing, and he hasn't done that. And these other events.
Do you think that has to be done as some kind of factual addendum to the appellate brief?
No, but I think he should at least state it. In combination with these events in the district court, never moving to withdraw his plea, which would have been the logical thing to do. Mm-hmm. He's never done that. Taken together, I think those would be sufficient to not remand and to deny it on the merits. Mm-hmm. If this court has no further questions, we'll rest on our brief. Thank you.
Mr. Sussman, you used up your rebuttal time, but you can have 2 minutes if you'd like it.
Just very briefly, Your Honor, two things. I mean, implicit in the appellant's request is that he would do something different if he were allowed to withdraw his plea. I mean, it would be worthless to try to withdraw the plea and be left in that situation if you weren't asserting your right to trial. The second thing that this court has always shown, I believe.
This is speculative, I guess, but when a defendant says that in such a proceeding, gets the plea lifted, is there anything on earth that prevents him from just renegotiating a new deal? Apart from prosecutorial impatience with him.
I would say likely the government is what prevents it. Clearly,
it's
that's
cheap. It's a cheap move that the defendant can make.
In the world of possibility, yes. In the world of practical consequences, the government's not likely to, unless situations change, is likely to reward someone for that. In my experience, but there is that possibility. This court has consistently shown due deference to factual determinations of the district court. In fact, when district courts make those determinations, they're very hard as an appellate matter to override. I think that the appropriate thing is to allow the district court to make that factual determination, and they're in the best posture. I think Judge Kavanaugh raised the kinds of questions that that the district court will have to answer in dealing with Mr. Zaitar's application. Thank you.
Thank you both. The case is submitted.